The following programming is sponsored by Dr. Joseph Fallon Jr. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
It's time once again to get inside the world of medicine as prominent endocrinologist Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. brings you Inside Medicine. Stay tuned for interviews with eminent medical specialists and receive vital information about your health. Now, here is Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. with another edition of Inside Medicine.
The City Center Convenience Mart. Well, John, the stage is set for the final transaction.
That's right, Joe. Heather's moment has arrived, and you just hope all that training pays off.
Heather lays down her purchase, but Randy rings it up as slowly as he can.
He is a wily veteran.
It gives Heather's eyes the chance to wander.
Uh-oh.
Yep, she's looking at the cigarettes.
There's nothing good back there. Quit now, and in 5 years, your odds of getting certain cancers drop 50%.
Meanwhile, Randy's stone-faced. He's giving nothing away. He just stands there, wetting his cashier's finger on that sponge.
Heather toes the rubber.
Here we go. Heather's arm is in motion. But instead of pointing at the back wall, she just grabs the gum off the counter.
That's a slick move.
Heather, back, back, back. She is out of there. Even Randy tips his cap to Heather. Stand Up to Cancer and Rally wants you to reduce your risk for cancer.
Go to takeahealthystand.org.
My daughter is Marina. Marina has a rare form of children's eye cancer, retinoblastoma. Her doctor sent us to a specialist, and then the specialist sent us to St. Jude. Within the first couple weeks of us getting here, I was just so scared. Like, I think the reality just hit me, and it kind of hit me all at once. I had started to cry, and her doctor came in, Dr. Brennan came in, and just didn't even say anything, sat down beside me, and, like, hugged me and held me while I, like, was literally sobbing. And she just said, it's gonna be okay. We don't have to worry anymore. The treatment worked, and we've saved her eye. This place has been such a blessing for us. There's no way you could have paid for treatment back home if we had to. We can come here and we can just solely focus on taking care of her and helping her heal.
Finding cures, saving children. Learn more at stjude.org.
Hi, Dr. Joe Fallon here. Sorry for that little interruption here, but I want to talk about, we have an excellent guest on.
It's going to be Dr. Jerry Burke. Jerry is a reproductive endocrinologist and an attorney. He's been in business a long time. He's got an excellent reputation, and I'm going to just talk about longevity for just a few minutes, and then Jerry's going to get the program. So TIA Kraft instituted that generally 35% of adults could answer the question, what's your life expectancy, which is 65 years, which is 84 for men and 87 for women, based on the estimated life expectancy from Social Security Administration. Some confusion is understandable. America has seen a decline in life expectancy in recent years, think of COVID, to just 74.8 for men and 80.2 for women in 2002. Life expectancy is expected to average a number of years left at a given age, so half of the people live longer. So-called deaths of despair, deaths by suicide, drug and alcohol poisoning, and chronic alcoholism have contributed to this slide alongside, more recently, the COVID pandemic. In fact, COVID almost overtook cardiovascular death in the United States of America the year they were peaking out. People who make it to 65 will probably live longer. Couples tend to live to even better. There's a 25% chance that one member of a 65-year-old heterosexual couple in average health will survive to age 96. Fantastic. Even the average life expectancy of 65 will take most retirees past the so-called break-even age for Social Security. The overall deal is, it just seems wrong to me for people to focus on unpredictable future without living joyfully in the present. So don't worry about it. Get yourself in shape. See your doc. Do your exercise. And we'll be in business. Now, let me just, I want to introduce Dr. Jerry Burke. Dr. Jerry Burke is a reproductive endocrinologist and an attorney. He practices in Evesham, New Jersey, on Evesham Road in Voorhees, New Jersey. He's been in business a long time. He's got exquisite expertise in infertility, and we'll also talk about IVF and the need that you don't, all girls don't need IVF. It's practice. Other issues. But Jerry is with us, a physician, boarded reproductive endocrinologist and attorney. Jerry, welcome to Inside Medicine.
Well, thank you, Joe, and good morning. It's a pleasure to be here with you this morning. And I must start this program off by saying that there was an article published in JAMA this week, which was a report of the initial success that they've had with uterine transplants, believe it or not, from Baylor University. Over the last several years, there have been three universities that have been participating in a uterine transplant program. Those are Baylor down in Houston, the University of Pennsylvania right here in the Delaware Valley in Philadelphia, and also the Cleveland Clinic. And their success has been surprising in my mind, but it's really a tribute to those who are participating in it. The University of Alabama, as a matter of fact, at Birmingham, is opening up a program next week, and Johns Hopkins is going to get starting a program early next year. And why this is remarkable is the fact that there is one form of infertility that up to this point in time, the only approach to treatment was either using a surrogate or adoption, and that was if you had a uterine factor, which is the reason why you couldn't conceive. And roughly one in 500 couples who have fertility problems, it's because the uterus is not capable of either conceiving or carrying a pregnancy. And so in this program, the Baylor University program reported on their first 20 individuals who had gone through their transplant program. What they had was 18 patients who had a rare condition called Meyer-Rokitansky-Kuster-Hauser syndrome, where they are born without a uterus and the upper part of the vagina and the fallopian tubes. The other two had lost, the patients that were involved in the study had lost their uterus to non-cancerous surgical conditions requiring hysterectomy. And what they found was that they were not only able to accomplish the transplant of a uterus into another person and have the body maintain it in
high capability status.
Yes, 14 of the cases, but once they maintained them, those uteruses were just as effective as any other uterus in maintaining a pregnancy and carrying it to a viable conclusion. What they did was they did all the conceptions through IVF, and I'm sure that they were testing the blastocyst or the eggs to make sure they were getting optimal egg
to efficacy.
Efficacy, but then they also came in and got excellent pregnancy rates. They had a 70% pregnancy rate where individuals had either one or two children eventually through one or two pregnancies. They were then performing hysterectomies and removing the uterus so that the person no longer had to undergo the immunosuppressive therapy after they had received or after they had had all the children that they were interested in. But they conceived quickly. They had no problems carrying. And the complication rates both for the pregnancy and for the surgery to both harvest the uterus from the donor and to implant the uterus in the recipient were having no increased risk of any medical or surgical issues. So it's really indicative of a successful program, and I have to doff my cap to them, to the folks who've gone through developing these programs, because I can remember when they were first talking about it years ago, I was somewhat dubious as far as what the efficacy would be. But it does work. The only big issue right now is the cost, which is currently placed at about $250,000 for the entire procedure or the entire process. However, with our shifting mores in our country, who knows? Possibly soon it will be covered under insurance. So it's a tip of the hat to the folks at Baylor, Penn, and at the Cleveland Clinic for exploring this procedure and developing it to this point. So that's my report on that.
Jerry, that's a fantastic report, and the effect that this went through three institutions is great. And I do know, I think you said the University of Penn had also been tracking that way too. Also, but let me just move on a second, because fertility has obvious cost to it. But what are non-IVF options to build a family? 50% of couples to have access to IVF as a fertility treatment because the cost is high. Can you give a little overview of non-IVF option for fertility?
Sure, Joe. What a lot of people don't realize, because the focus on fertility care these days is so much focused on in vitro fertilization, that they don't realize that traditional methods of enhancing fertility, which have excellent success rates, are still available and work very well. What you're going to see is that only about 50% of couples are going to have access to in vitro fertilization at any time during their lives. And the reason for that is primarily cost. Currently in the state of New Jersey, certain insurances are required to provide up to 4 lifetime cycles of in vitro fertilization. Now, that doesn't mean 4 children, because unfortunately, not every cycle of in vitro fertilization results in the birth of a live child. But that's the limitation where that is concerned. So that if a couple doesn't have the insurance coverage, you're talking, in most cases, that a standard cycle costs between $20,000 and $30,000. And for many people, they're going to find that outside of their ability to cover with their budget. There's other couples that just feel uncomfortable about what they find to be an impersonal approach at some in vitro fertilization clinics. Others have religious restrictions, for instance, Catholics who follow the doctrine and dogma of the church, and some Jewish groups. Other people have concerns about what happens with the frozen embryos and recognize that with some of your genetic testing with in vitro fertilization, when you actually remove a cell from the embryo, that what you're doing is creating an entire new identical twin, and that's what you're doing your testing on. In other cases, IVF just hasn't worked for people. And what you'll find frequently when you review the data and the for these people's care is that a lot of times you can work with them with traditional methods, and about a third to a half will still conceive, even though they failed several cycles of in vitro fertilization. So that there's a lot of space and a lot of room for people and a lot of need for the treatment with non-IVF-oriented fertility treatments. And other advantages include the fact that individuals get not only an individualized approach to their care, but they have much more control over their care and much more input into what things they will and won't do. And it's much less of an assembly line approach to the care.
Can I ask you something, Jerry?
Sure.
So IVF is kind of like the thing that most people go to today if they have a fertility issue. The object is, what are the other options? Because you were intimating that there are other potential options that have high efficacy in a couple getting pregnant. So can you just delve into that alternative?
Sure. The first thing you need to do is you need to evaluate the couple to see why they are not conceiving. And an appropriately worked up couple or evaluated couple, you'll find the cause for their inability to conceive approximately 90% of the time. Now, it doesn't mean you can always correct it, but in a high percentage of them you can, and result in a pregnancy. And so what we're talking about is looking at the couple as a couple with 3 basic areas. One is you want to check the husband's fertility potential. And that's easily done by screening with a semen analysis. And then depending on what you find there, if there's an issue, then working the husband up further to determine whether or not his issue may be genetic, it might be an anatomic condition, or it might be a hormonal problem, which the latter two can both be addressed and treated usually very successfully. And then you're also going to be simultaneously looking at and evaluating the wife in both terms of her ovulatory function and also in terms of her anatomic condition. And as far as ovulatory function is concerned, you want to confirm that she's ovulating, but then you want to evaluate the quality of the ovulation, because a lot of women are ovulating on a monthly basis, but they are not ovulating well enough to conceive or to carry a pregnancy. So that you want to evaluate that by way of traditionally basal body temperatures, serum progesterone and estradiol levels, and eventually perform an endometrial biopsy to confirm the adequacy of the hormone production from the ovulation on the lining of the uterus so as to be able to support a pregnancy. Once you have that addressed, frequently if there's no other issues, you'll have a conception ensue or very shortly thereafter. And then the third area that you want to check for the wife is her anatomic condition or her anatomic situation. And that can be several conditions, including obstruction of the fallopian tubes. It can be fibroids or uterine defects inside the uterine cavity. It can also be endometriosis, which is where the lining of the uterus grows in the abdominal cavity and can lead to scar tissue formation and infertility. Or you can have scarring from other surgeries or infections, which can all cause the fallopian tubes and the eggs not to be able to be picked up and fertilized by the sperm that's deposited.
So, Jerry, can you just give the audience just an anatomic deal? Because you indicated areas that things can go wrong and that a couple could not be successful. But you talked about fallopian tubes and uterus and that kind of stuff. Can you just go over the anatomy a little bit so that people get a better idea of how the differential diagnosis goes for you and your partners to get a successful pregnancy?
Sure. What we'll do initially from an anatomic perspective, I personally prefer to perform an X-ray study called a hysterosalpingogram. And this is a study which is done in the radiology department where dye is injected, speculum is inserted in the vagina, just like a pap test, and a small cannula is put inside the cervix, and dye is injected into the uterus, and it goes out the fallopian tubes while X-rays are being taken. And this will show you very clearly what the shape of the uterine cavity looks like, what the internal architecture of the fallopian tubes is, and whether or not the dye spills freely and spreads evenly throughout the pelvis, suggesting that all the tissues are fine and there's no scar tissue. If you find an abnormality with that, then you would want to further evaluate this and take the person to the operating room to do a laparoscopy and a hysteroscopy. And any time you take a person to the operating room, you want to make sure that you have the ability not just to diagnose conditions, but also to treat them at the same time. You don't want to have to take a person twice to the OR when a condition can be taken care of one time. And at that point in time, in the operating room, if you have issues inside the uterine cavity, you can frequently treat them with an operative hysteroscopy, which involves going through the cervix into the uterus and shaving down septums or fibroids and other anatomic structures that can either prevent pregnancy or cause miscarriages. On the laparoscopic side, which is inserting a scope through the belly button, you can frequently correct adhesions and free up the anatomic structures so that the fallopian tube is capable of sweeping the surface of the ovary and pick up eggs again. And you can also address your endometriosis, whether it's implants of endometriosis, which release prostaglandins, which reduce the fertility rate and the ability to conceive, or if they're cysts of endometriosis called endometriomas. They can be shelled out and removed completely so that you can dramatically enhance a person's fertility potential with the one simple trip to the operating room.
So, Jerry, it sounds like there's a big differential diagnosis here and that the surgeon or the reproductive endo really has to look things over from A to Z. The items that you talked about, is there anyone that comes up, number one, in the reason that someone couldn't get pregnant?
What I see most frequently is a condition called a luteal phase defect. And this is something which has gotten glossed over in the era of in vitro fertilization. What you find with most people, or with many couples, is that you'll find that the husband's count is fine you'll find that the wife's anatomic situation is fine. But when you evaluate her ovulations, you'll find that she is ovulating every month, but she's ovulating poorly. And she's either not ovulating well enough to get pregnant at all, or she's ovulating and conceiving but having an early miscarriage at 5 to 6 weeks. And this is a situation where you need to rule out any hormonal imbalances which could be causing her or contributing to her inability to ovulate well, such as an overproduction of the male hormones for androgens, an overproduction of prolactin, a hormone made in the pituitary that stimulates the breast to produce milk, or in lower levels can foul up ovulations. And also, you want to make sure that her thyroid function is working adequately. Many women, while they are not overtly hypothyroid or have an underactive gland, will have poor enough thyroid function that while it's still in the normal range technically, it's not adequate to be able to either conceive or to carry a pregnancy, and that would need to be corrected as well prior to a conception.
So, Jared, let me give you 1 second. I got to kick in here. At least I can add a little bit. So the bottom line is the average person has a TSH between 0.3 and 5, and it's very interesting, but people come in all the time and say, my TSH is normal. But if you're trying to get pregnant, your reproductive endocrine specialists across the Philadelphia marketplace and New Jersey marketplace all insist that the TSH be less than a 2.0. So when you're in the normal range, isn't a good answer if you're trying to get pregnant, because basically I would say you're going to shoot for a 0.6, no higher than a 1.5. But overall, the reproductive endo guys and gals really don't want to see if your TSH is above 2, and preferably it should be lower. And in fact, in my practice, I've seen remarkable benefits from putting people not in the normal range, but putting them in the fast side of normal for fertility. So, Jerry, let you take over from there. So when should a couple seek infertility care? Because you mentioned a number of the problems that it can be. It's a big little list, but you guys are used to going through it. But when is the time they should say, I need some help?
Joe, that's a great question, and that's something that's really important that everybody knows that. If you are if the woman is under 35 years of age, ordinarily what we ask is that the couple have unprotected intercourse occurring approximately 2 or 3 times a week for 12 months or a year prior to starting to evaluate them for a fertility issue. In those situations, what you'll find is that 90% of the time you will find a cause for their inability to conceive. And again, what you'll find is that ordinarily 60% of couples will conceive in the first 6 months of having unprotected intercourse 2 to 3 times a week, and another 25% or so, 20 to 25% will come in pregnant in the second 6 months. So that at the end of a year, if you are still having problems, that's when it's really worthwhile to see somebody and be evaluated. Now, that changes a little bit when you reach the age of 35, and that's primarily because at 35 we're starting to reach the point where a woman's ovulatory function naturally starts to decline, and so that we want to see the couple sooner at that point in time, generally after 6 months of having unprotected intercourse, for the woman 35 or older. But also, people that we want to see within 6 months are people who are starting to have irregular periods. Either their periods are from the first day of one period to the first day of the next is closer than 26 days, 26 to 7 days, or over 35 days. That frequently is an indication that the person has an ovulatory problem. Also, we want to see couples when they have 2 or more miscarriages without any living children, because those couples clearly have a problem going on and they need to be evaluated and the problem addressed. Also, if a wife knows that she has an anatomic problem with endometriosis or pelvic adhesions, you're going to also want to see them after 4 to 6 cycles of unprotected intercourse to make sure that there's not an anatomic cause for her not being able to conceive. Obviously, if somebody has a tubal ligation, you want to get them in and get that reversed because they're not going to conceive with the tubal ligation still in place. And the one thing that a lot of people don't think about these days is the issue of ectopic pregnancies or tubal pregnancies in the fallopian tube. Once you've had the incidence of ectopic pregnancies, used to be roughly 1 in 120. Now it's somewhere between 1 and 2% of couples will have had at least one ectopic pregnancy. And the problem with an ectopic pregnancy is that, first off, once you've had one, you have about a 10 to 20% or a 1 in 10 chance to 1 in 20 chance of getting another one, actually closer to 1 in 10. So it is a repetitive thing, because usually whatever damaged the tube on the one side also is damaged or affected the tube on the other side. And the biggest problem that we're seeing these days is that when people have had one ectopic pregnancy, their OBGYN takes them to the operating room, takes the tube out, and tells them that they did a great job and they saved their lives, which they did. But the problem is now they have one tube left. And when you have one tube left, you need to find, if you develop another ectopic pregnancy in that tube, you need to find somebody who's capable of performing what's a surgical procedure called a linear salpingostomy. And what that is a laparoscopic procedure where you can make an incision over the portion of the fallopian tube where the pregnancy is, and you can shell it out, and it will control the bleeding, and it will heal by itself, and they can conceive again in the future through that tube. And one of the issues is, to all too many general OBGYNs, when the person's had one ectopic pregnancy and they develop and they take the tube out, and then they develop an ectopic pregnancy in the other tube, they take that tube out too and say, oh, she can go to IVF. And the reality is there's a very good chance that IVF will never be available to her. So that preservation of that fallopian tube is important. So that I'm recommending to women that if they've had one ectopic pregnancy where the fallopian tube was removed, that they want to make darn sure that when they're looking to pursue other pregnancies, that they be doing so under the guidance of a reproductive endocrinologist who can get them in the hands of somebody who can perform a linear salpingostomy and conserve or save that remaining fallopian tube. A lot of times people say, oh, if you've had an ectopic pregnancy, you're just going to get another one in there by conserving the tube. But that's not the case. I can tell you from personal experience, I had one patient that jumps to my mind in particular, came to me with one tube because she'd lost the other one to an ectopic pregnancy. And I ended up taking four ectopic pregnancies out of her remaining fallopian tube on separate occasions before she finally got pregnant and snuck a pregnancy down into the uterus. And that lady now has five children and has had no further ectopic pregnancies. So it's a very important consideration if you've had an ectopic pregnancy and lost a fallopian tube.
Can I ask you something, Jer?
Yeah.
What about methotrexate? Does that have a role in these tubal issues?
It does have a role. It's important that you diagnose the ectopic pregnancy very early on, because with methotrexate, what you're looking to do is, methotrexate is a cancer chemotherapeutic agent, but it works by killing rapidly dividing cells. And the placenta is rapidly dividing, so that when you have established that you have a pregnancy in the fallopian tube, you can frequently treat it by administering either one or two injections of methotrexate that will kill the placenta, and the pregnancy reabsorbs, and you again have good patency or open fallopian tubes when you're done. So that it's a very viable way to treat an early pregnancy. The problem is, once you get a pregnancy to the point where you have fetal heart motion noted on ultrasound, that you tend not to get an appropriate and adequate effect with methotrexate, and you end up having to go to a surgical approach.
So, Jared, can we just move on a second? So what can you expect with the traditional approach to your fertility care? What are pregnancy rates?
What you're talking about are overall pregnancy rates in the 50 to 60% range, depending on the individual that you are treating you. What you find is that you get, first off, it's frequently covered by insurance. You get fewer multiple pregnancies, particularly your high-order multiple pregnancies like triplets and quads, so that you're not dealing with the prematurity issues that you do with in vitro fertilization, where you frequently get twins and occasionally even the triplets and the quads. And again, you're getting a much more personalized attention and care as far as your conception is concerned. But you're talking roughly 50%. The interesting thing is, Joe, my experience has been that when a couple works with me and we reach the point where we go through the entire gamut short of in vitro fertilization, when they go to IVF, they don't get 65% pregnancy rates, which is what's generally reported in IVF. They get about a 12% pregnancy rate, which is about what it was years ago. And the reason for that is that a lot of your 65% pregnancy rate for IVF is what we like to refer to as they catch the low-hanging fruit, where they basically are doing in vitro fertilization for folks that really don't need it. But so they have a much higher pregnancy rate with it. And I can understand where they're at. Patients want to get pregnant right away, A. And B, it's a very competitive market in vitro fertilization, and patients look very critically at the clinic success rate when they're making the decision about where they want to have their in vitro fertilization care taken care of.
Okay, well, that generates a significant do your homework before you move forward, I guess, in your get a baby modus operandi. What does a traditional non-IVF approach to infertility treatment entail? So this is traditional non-IVF approach.
Well, we've alluded to it already that you're going to check evaluate the three areas of the couple: the husband's fertility potential, the wife's ovulatory function, and the wife's anatomic condition. And ordinarily what you'll find is that anywhere from 50-50 to 60-40, it's going to be the female to male who's going to have the primary problem. But what you have to realize is that not infrequently, it's not that either the wife is sterile or completely infertile or the husband's sterile or completely infertile. But what you have is a situation where they are both subfertile, and if she had married a different guy who was very fertile, I wouldn't see them. They might not get pregnant in the first 6 months, but they get pregnant in the second 6 months. Or vice versa, if he'd married a very fertile woman, they would have conceived and you'd never see them. So that's a real reality in the situation. And my job as a reproductive endocrinologist is to maximize both of their fertility's potential, and that's where we get the conceptions.
Okay. So that means, how often is it the guy's fault as opposed to the female fault? Are there stats out on that?
Well, again, grossly when you're looking at it, it's anywhere from 50-50 between the husband and the wife to 60-40 in favor of the wife having the issue more frequently than the husband. But like I said, the reality is you really are looking to optimize or maximize the fertility potential of both partners.
Got it. And how long does it take a reproductive endocrinologist to get that answer? Who's responsible, or both responsible, or is it was just bad luck?
We'll know that within 2 to 3 cycles, particularly because we're doing the evaluation on both the husband and the wife simultaneously, and we generally can sit down and have a discussion exactly what's going on and consider the various options to address whatever the issue may be.
Got it. So let's just hit the guys first. How do you evaluate for the, quote, male factor?
Well, the guys are by far the easiest, and the easiest way to do that is to check a semen analysis. And there, what you're going to do is ask the husband to produce a specimen that can be evaluated within an hour underneath a microscope, and you can get a knowledge of how many sperm he has per cc, his count, how many are swimming, how well they're swimming, if there's any suggestion of infection there, or if there's any other issues that might need to be addressed with this specimen quality. This can later be confirmed that he's doing well with a test called a postcoital test, where immediately prior to ovulation, you ask the couple to have relations, and then have the wife come in and putting a speculum in the vagina. Like a pap test, you would get a little bit of the wife's mucus from her cervix and look at that underneath the microscope. At mid-cycle, a wife's cervical mucus under the influence of estrogen is very thin, watery, and runny, kind of like what one gets when they get a cold with a runny nose. And in that mucus, sperm can survive and fertilize eggs without any decrease in the per-cycle pregnancy rate. 48 hours between episodes of intercourse, and only a slight drop-off at 72 hours between episodes of intercourse. Then when you go beyond 72, then the chances of conceiving in that particular cycle starts to drop off more significantly.
Got it. So the answer here is that how fast I thought there's an issue of how fast, if someone gives a specimen, that they have to get it to the lab to do their sperm count. Is there a timing issue?
Yes, there is. You want to get it to the lab and you within an hour, and you want to keep it warm. And the easiest way to keep it warm is just to put it on an inside shirt pocket so that your body temperature is keeping it warm. You don't want to let it get cold, and you don't want to let it sit around, because when that happens, the sperm motility, the number swimming, starts to go down.
So I guess when you're looking for an infertility doctor, you got to make sure that they have some trees close by so that they can run over them.
I've never thought about it quite that way, Joe. That's all I can say.
Yeah, well, I've heard guys telling me that they were using the local trees to make sure they got there quick. So God help us.
God bless them is all I can say.
Yes. Okay, so let's ask about, go to the gal side. What is ovulation quality?
Well, ovulation quality is determining whether, not only if she's ovulating, but is she ovulating well enough to conceive? And much of that involves, is she ovulating well enough to produce the hormonal production she needs, particularly the progesterone, in order to be able to develop the lining of the uterus adequately, so that when the fertilized egg, which gets fertilized in the far part of the fallopian tube out by the ovary, and it is free in the tube for 3 days, then it comes into the uterine cavity and is free in the uterine cavity for another 4 days, so that it implants about a week after ovulation. And you want that lining of the uterus to be adequately developed so that it can support and nourish that fertilized embryo and carry it to term. And when that's not occurring, that's called a luteal phase defect. And there's actually what I like to refer to as two flavors of luteal phase defects. One is the flavor where the lining is not too badly off, and they'll conceive, but they end up miscarrying at 5.5 to 6 weeks. And those are usually, those individuals usually experience that fairly repetitively, and they really aren't that hard to help correct that issue, either by supplementing them with progesterone in the second half of their cycle, which augments what they are naturally producing from their ovaries after they ovulate, or by actually improving their ovulation using an agent, an oral medication such as Clomid or Latrazole. The other flavor of the luteal phase defect is the one who's not conceiving at all, and they tend to be the much more difficult individuals to help conceive. And there are pregnancy success rates only about 40%, and that's probably because there's probably more than meets the eye their inability to conceive, and it's not something that we can evaluate for. And I suspect personally that what we are seeing is they probably have some undetectable chromosomal issues with the quality of their eggs, and that's the reason why we're not able to get the same pregnancy rates as you do with either those who don't ovulate at all or those who ovulate but ovulate poorly.
So does that luteal defect include things like thyroid hormones not on the tip-top side, or that they have something wrong with the pituitary, so they have galactorrhea or something like that?
Most definitely, because that the luteal phase defect frequently is a manifestation of a hormonal imbalance, which is throwing off their ovulations. And when you throw off the ovulations, that's the natural order that it's not a case that you'd, sometimes you don't ovulate at all, but not infrequently, you'll ovulate every month, but poorly, and manifest a luteal phase defect. And that's the reason why we evaluate everybody with a complete hormonal profile, looking to check both their FSH and LH, the two hormones made from the pituitary, which stimulate the ovaries. We check their testosterone levels. We check their thyroid levels. We check their prolactin levels. We check their estradiols and progesterone levels. And then we will frequently end up also doing evaluating them for insulin resistance. And what I like to do is a full 3-hour glucose tolerance test with insulin levels on each specimen that's drawn. And not infrequently we'll find that these individuals are what's known as insulin resistant, which has issues with conception, because insulin not only causes sugar to be driven intracellularly, but it has a lot of other anabolic activities or growth-promoting activities. And one of the things it does on the ovary is it directly stimulates a particular cell type of cell in the ovary called the thecal cells to step up their testosterone production. And while testosterone is normally produced in the ovaries, it's also then transformed through the enzyme aromatase into estradiol, which is the main estrogen that women produce and is important as far as egg development, follicle development, ovulation, and pregnancy. However, if the testosterone levels get high in the ovaries because the elevated insulin levels are stimulating the fecal cells, then the testosterone will shut off the aromatase enzyme, which ordinarily converts testosterone to estrogen, so that you end up getting a spillover of testosterone into the bloodstream. You either ovulate poorly or don't ovulate at all, and you can even end up with a picture that, at least on ultrasound, looks like classic polycystic ovarian syndrome, which it's just doesn't have the classic etiology or cause of it.
So I do want to point out right here, Jerry's given some information out that's a little bit complex. This podcast of this show will be up after the show, hopefully within an hour or preferably sooner, so that if somebody wants to go back and play it, they can hit www.wwdbam.com. Then you want to look for Inside Medicine, the name of this program, and then hit Inside Medicine and then go to podcast, and you'll be able to hear things over and flip it back, flip it forward, so that if you want to digest some of this stuff that's a little bit quick, if you're not in the business, that you can get more information, figure it out, because Jerry's giving you a very detailed way of a reproductive endocrinologist thinking, and you want to make sure that you can get your checklist up by listening to Jerry's advice here. So Jerry...
Let me make one more comment about that. That's one of the things that I stress to all my patients, particularly the new patients, is that there's nothing that we're doing that is not very simple and very logical. It's just that for the patients, it's the first time through for them, and that there's nothing that they is difficult to understand, and that they should always know where we're at and where we're going. We're not ever walking blindly into the darkness. We always have a game plan about where we're going, where we're at, and where we're going, and how we're going to address things. So, just you don't want to be overwhelmed. It's very simple. It's very logical. It's just that it's the first time through for you, and that makes it confusing.
Good. So www.wwdbam.com, hit Inside Medicine, and then hit Podcast, and you'll have like 125 up, and you can check for Dr. Burke. He has been on, I know, once before, so you might want to go back a little bit. But let me just move forward here a second. People talk about Clomid. Can you help the audience out? Why would a reproductive endocrinologist or use Clomid?
Well, Clomid and another medication which we've been starting to use in the last 10 years, which also works well, called Latrazole, are oral medications. And what they do is they help the woman, they help her to improve her ovulations. What they are actually doing is almost like when you have to prime a water pump to get it to carry water, you're priming the normal cycling mechanism between the brain, the pituitary gland, and the ovaries. And by priming this system, you get a much better quality ovulation, which includes not only egg quality, but also hormone production. And you will frequently be able to conceive full-term healthy pregnancy without any problems in that respect.
So how long has Clomid been on the market?
Clomid's been on the market since the early 60s. And it's interesting because they were actually looking to develop an anti-estrogen, and it turned out that it had some levels estrogenic activity and other levels anti-estrogenic activities. And it eventually found its home really in fertility and ovulation induction.
All right, fantastic. So when you write up your lab slip, what are some of the items that you order on a lab slip for a gal to make sure that she's got high-level fertility capability?
Well, what I really want to do is I want to make sure that there's no hormonal imbalances. And as we mentioned earlier, we'll check a FSH and LH, which is follicle-stimulating hormone and luteinizing hormone, the two hormones made in the pituitary that stimulate the ovaries. We will check an estradiol and a progesterone because they give us an indication of the response of the ovary to those hormones. Then we'll check a testosterone and a DHEA sulfate, which is a weak androgen made 97% from the adrenals and has a pretty good gland of adrenal gland androgen production. We'll also check the thyroid functions and the prolactin. Prolactin, of course, being made in the pituitary gland and it stimulates the breast to produce milk, but in lower levels confound populations. The other thing we'll do, if a woman's in her early 30s, 32, 33, frequently we'll check an AMH or an anti-Müllerian hormone. And what we find is that it correlates frequently to the fertility potential of the eggs that the woman has left in her ovaries. And we'll start to check it at 32 and definitely check it as women get into their late 30s and early 40s, because it's important to know what, get some indication of what the quality of the eggs are that are left in her ovaries. If they're significantly compromised, I think that's important that people know that, because that may make a difference in the decisions they make as far as pursuing family building. In the same breath, if the AMH is good, that gives us some confidence that pursuing more traditional means of ovulation induction and fertility care are going to be optimal for that person.
Okay, so I think, can you just go back? I think you were talking about prolactin. Can you, where does that come from, and what does that do for the female to get pregnant?
Well, prolactin is a hormone made in the pituitary gland, and like I say, ordinarily with pregnancy and delivery, it stimulates the breast to produce milk. But prolactin can at times be elevated from various causes. One of the common causes of elevation of prolactin is that the thyroid is underactive, because the hormone that stimulates the thyroid to release the thyroid hormone, TRH from the hypothalamus, also seems to cause the release of prolactin, but frequently by correcting an underactive thyroid, the prolactin will go down. If it doesn't, then you have to correct the prolactin directly as well. And that's usually with an oral medication. I still like to use Parlodil, but there's other longer-acting medications you can use for that. And then relatively infrequently, at least in my practice, you'll find that they have a small growth in the pituitary gland called a microadenoma, which generally just needs to be followed unless it's starting to, unless it's not responding to medication. But that's something that when I have those issues, I send them over to you, Joe.
Okay. Well, what I like about the prolactin is, like, you know, one of the reasons that when people are pregnant, basically and deliver, the prolactin tends to go up so they can make milk, but in doing so, they cause the woman to be infertile. So it's interesting how God works. You know, he says, hey, look, you just had a baby. We're going to make sure you don't get pregnant again right away. And again, also, a lot of times you find somebody who can't have a child because they're hypothyroid, because the hypothyroidism drives the prolactin up, because the body says, hey, look, you don't have enough thyroid, so you're not going to get pregnant. So it's a really interesting to and fro, and it's one of the easiest things to fix. You just got to make the diagnosis. So, Jared, let me just move forward a second here. So there's always these temperature gauges that people want to take, and they apparently you have to get fancy ones if you're trying to use body temperature assessment in fertility issues. Can you talk about basal body temperature charting?
Yes. Basal body temperature charting is one of the simplest things to do. It can give you a lot of information, and it essentially costs nothing more than your time and an oral digital thermometer. I know, Joe, you're referring to the various gadgets that people have and the apps on phones as far as that's concerned. And if people want to use that, that's fine. But personally, I like to use a temperature chart that I've been using since I was a fellow, and I'm used to those spatial relations as far as graphing the temperature. And what happens is each morning before a woman gets out of bed, you ask her to take her temperature. With a digital thermometer, which costs about $10, that'll take about 20 or 30 seconds to get a reading. And you want her to do that before she gets out of bed to go to the bathroom or walk around, because just that much activity can start to cause their body temperature to rise. And what you find is that for most women, their temperature before they ovulate is going to be below 98 degrees. And after they ovulate, with the production of the hormone progesterone, the thermostat in their hypothalamic area in their brain gets set up about a degree, and they'll be over 98 degrees. And so that by looking at basal body temperature charts, you can frequently tell if a person's ovulating, when they're ovulating, and get a very good idea about the quality of their ovulation, because if from the time they ovulate to the onset of their period is less than 12 days, that in and of itself will diagnose a luteal phase defect for you.
So, Jared, we have a little bit of time left. How do you optimize fertility potential of a couple?
Well, what you're looking to do is, again, if the wife has any ovulatory problems, you want to address that. If the husband has, and correct that, and that can mean correcting hormonal imbalances, but then usually adding an ovulation-inducing agent after you have done that, including Clomid or Latrazole. And the nice thing about Latrazole and Clomid is that they can act complementary to each other in that they don't work by the same mechanism, so that if you get you are using a maximal dose of one and not getting the quality of ovulation you need, you can then add the other one on, and that helps you to not have to go to the injectable medications. If you're not getting an adequate ovulation with that, then you have to go to the injectable medications, where you can, which are a combination of either FSH or FSH and LH that are given on a daily basis while the eggs are developing to stimulate the egg growth and development. But that's with the wife. Obviously, with the husband, you want to check his count. If the husband has a normal count and everything's good, you're fine. If he's got a real either no sperm or a count of less than 5 million per cc, you will not infrequently find, about half the time you'll find that they truly are not producing sperm. But the other half the time they have an obstruction, either from a previous infection or the like, and that can be fixed surgically, and you get a great pregnancy rate with that because the guy is suddenly back to normal. And if you find that it's not the case that there's an obstruction, but the guy's counts below the 20 million they're looking for with 60% swimming sperm and about 60 million swimming sperm in the ejaculate, you can give them low-dose Clomid at 25 milligrams a day for extended periods of time. And very frequently that will serve to markedly improve their count. You also want to treat any infections they might have, so that if the semen analysis specimen has a lot of white blood cells in it, you generally aren't going to get much if you culture it, but if you treat them with a month's worth of either Cipro or doxycycline, you'll see that the white blood cells clear up, and all of a sudden their count goes up and the number of sperm swimming goes up, and their fertility parameters improve dramatically.
The Army, you just have this brotherhood that you can't find anywhere else. Since coming home from war, I've tried so many different things. I just remember thinking, like, it's over.
After being forced to medically retire, Angie battled addiction to prescription medications, eventually losing her house and marriage. Then she found Wounded Warrior Project.
And so I went online, I signed up, and I knew that Wounded Warrior Project was definitely my new community. One of the staff members, she put me in for peer mentor training. It was like for the first time someone recognized something good about me and thought that I had something to give back to someone else. Are you doing okay otherwise?
I've kind of picked up woodworking with my grandfather.
Oh, yeah.
So
I saw 3D stuff.
All those activities gave me a new way to live without drugs, a new way to live without feeling like I'm broken. You can live a meaningful life after traumatic experiences.
You wouldn't go into battle alone. You don't have to fight this alone. Visit woundedwarriorproject.org/not alone.
Somewhere around 400 feet off the ground, an RPG came through the belly of the aircraft. When I first got out, I felt like my whole life had been smooshed down to just medical appointments. I was going to occupational therapy, physical therapy, speech therapy. We don't talk about the female combat wounded. These are our daughters and our sisters and our mothers. I'm not sure I would still be here if I didn't find the Friends and Wounded Warrior Project that I did. Because there was a long period after the injury where I really didn't understand why I was still here. I felt like I had lost everything. Wounded Warrior Project came into my life and taught me how to stand back up and get back in the fight. The truth is, I think we all have this strength inside of us, but until you're tested, you just don't know it's there.
See how Wounded Warrior Project empowers women veterans like Beth by visiting woundedwarriorproject.org/empowerwomenvets.
We don't do controversy and we don't create issues. What we do on the Museum of Sports Show on WWDB 860 AM is present fun, fascinating guests from the world of sports, especially Philadelphia sports. We've got the greatest sports fans in the greatest sports town, and we don't stir things up just to get them riled. They're way too smart for that. We're live 4 to 5 p.m. Thursdays on WWDB 860 AM and on Facebook.
Hey, Philly, you know what's going on. It's The Scene with Doreen. And yes, that's me, Doreen Taylor, bringing you all my celebrity friends from TV, movies, music, sports, and so much more. Spend an exciting hour with me each week as I sit down to chat with guests, and you never know what surprises I may have in store. Hey, not to brag, but come see why Huffington Post named me one of the hottest talents to keep your eyes on. So tune in every Thursday morning at 8 a.m. right here on Philly's number one talk radio station, WWDB, for The Scene with Doreen.
Are you raising the child of a loved one? You're not alone.